Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
I'm your host for this edition of Green Sense.
And I'm Bob Kessler, your executive producer. Robert, we're going to get into the Carbon X Prize. This is something you know something about.
Yes, I attended an X Prize visioning session. What a wonderful organization, and it's a great market-based solution to starting new economies.
And we'll find out who their big finalist innovators are for this year. They just handed out about 10 X Prizes. Autonomous cars, as we found out recently, you know, they can get into accidents, but will we be safer in the long run? But also, there's another question, without humans in the equation when it comes to driving, who's responsible? So in other words, who do you sue when a driverless car crashes? We'll be asking an environmental lawyer about that.
Ooh, deep question and maybe even a deeper answer, all coming up on today's show. A $20 million prize to innovators coming up with ways to solve humanity's grand challenge is being split 10 ways for the Carbon X Prize finalists who were just announced. Joining us now with a look at the winners is Dr. Marcus Extibor, X Prize Senior Director of Energy and Resources. Welcome to Green Sense, Marcus.
Hey there, it's great to be here.
I'm a big advocate of X Prize challenges. I was invited to participate in a visioning session on food and saw firsthand the power of taking a market-based approach to solving environmental issues. Can you give our audience just a short summary of the XPRIZE mission and the competition that you've established here?
Happy to. The XPRIZE mission is all about trying to bring incentives to solving some of humanity's grand challenges. What does that mean? It means that we structure and design prize competitions and throw the problems out to the world to say, hey, if you're an innovator, if you've got solutions out there that can address one of these grand challenges, we'd love to see you compete and demonstrate, not just to win the grand prize, which is always a large cash purse, but to try to inspire others to really accelerate a space and go forward. And I'll just give you one example. The NRG COSIA Carbon X Prize, the thing I spend most of my time on, is about climate change. It's about energy sustainability. It's about getting to a new and low carbon future, specifically. It's a $20 million competition for anyone in the world to demonstrate they can actually convert and recycle CO2 emissions and put them to productive use to make a valuable product. That's what this competition is all about.
Well, thank you. And what I liked about the session I attended most is that when people don't succeed and become a finalist, they still have the opportunity to create the groundwork of a whole new industry. And a great example of that was SpaceX and all the new private space industry that was established just from that prize. So tell us a little bit about what happens with the entrants who may not make it to the finals. Do they often still see their projects through even if they don't make it and win a portion of that prize?
Absolutely. Look, the type of people that we see, the type of companies, organizations that enter XPRIZE competitions, they're all in it not just because of the XPRIZE, but they're in it because they're trying to reach that ultimate end goal themselves. And they see the XPRIZE often as a way to accelerate and really push them further and faster than they might have before. So one thing we like to say at XPRIZE is that it's not just about declaring a winner. It's not just about selecting a singular technology breakthrough. It's also about uplifting the whole space by trying to showcase a range of interesting solutions. Your SpaceX example is a great one. They weren't the winner of the prize, but they have come to be one of the winners in the private space industry. The purpose of the prize first was to select a winner, but really it was about opening up private space industry. The analogy in carbon is that it's not just about trying to give away $20 million. It's about trying to showcase a whole range of ways to convert CO2 into productive products. And that's what we're seeing among our finalists.
The private sector designed and built Spaceship One became a reality in 2004 thanks to XPRIZE. That's probably one of your highest profile winners and really what put XPRIZE on the map. But how many other lesser known but still important innovators have become reality thanks to the XPRIZE competition?
Ah, well, there's quite a few out there, and we're always happy to speak about them. A prize called the Ocean Discovery, or the Wendy Schmidt Ocean Health XPRIZE, that wrapped up a couple of years ago. That was about a relatively understudied challenge, how to put ocean pH sensors and distribute them throughout the ocean. We all knew that ocean was becoming more acidic as a result of changing climate and CO2 buildup, but there was very little pH data in the oceans. This prize was about building a better, more nimble, deployable sensor, not the type of thing that would take 6 months for one ship to use, but you could scatter dozens or hundreds of these in the ocean, collect data, gather them up again, et cetera. And that that's an example of a competition that was awarded. I think we awarded it in 2015 or 16. And the winners have already gone on to demonstrate their solution at scale to produce new ocean data. The sensors were deployed, I think, off the coast of East Africa for the first time to get some ocean pH data from that region for the first time. A couple of other competitions I'll just mention that we're already seeing interesting innovations come out of even before the competitions are awarded. That's the Carbon X Prize, which is my focus, but the Adult Literacy X Prize, the Global Learning X Prize. These are ongoing competitions in which not all the teams have advanced in the final stages, but already we're seeing great innovations come out sort of from the side of these competitions, even before we get to the ultimate winner.
Even though your goal is to create markets, you have to come up with the prize, and you're a nonprofit. So where does the money come from to put out such lucrative prizes?
Each of our prizes has a sponsor, or sometimes a group of sponsors. So XPRIZE will go out and try to build a sponsorship team or a sponsorship group on the basis of the grand challenge and the concept for the competition itself. Some of our prizes are funded by individuals, some by companies, some by a mix. The NRG COSIA Carbon X Prize, for instance, got two title sponsors. They're both from the private sector, but we have a range of sponsors in our competitions over the years.
I'm talking with Dr. Marcus Extibor about the Carbon X Prize competition here on GreenSense. Well, Dr. Extibor, let's look at this year's finalists. And if you could tell us more about what makes them innovative. So the first one is Breathe. It's producing methanol, a common fuel and petrochemical feedstock, using a novel catalyst.
Breathe is a really interesting team, not just because they're based in Bangalore, which itself is an innovation hub. Breathe is trying to make a well-known material in a better way. Methanol is a possible replacement fuel for gasoline, which means you could put it in your car and burn it. You might not want to do that today because it'll ruin your warranty, but the point is cars can run on methanol. It's a real fuel. But it's also a valuable industrial chemical. So the product is not new, but the method of making methanol is new. The catalyst, for the non-chemists out there, this is sort of the secret ingredient that unlocks the chemical process to transform the CO2 into methanol. This team thinks they can do it better than it's been done before.
The next one is Carbon Capture Machine from Scotland is producing solid carbonates with applications to building materials. Explain what that's all about.
Sure. One of the most interesting, if you're in the CO2 field, people debate about how much energy do you need to whack the CO2 molecule with to turn it into something else? And usually the answer is actually quite a bit. In the previous example, methanol is a high energy molecule. That's why it's good for a fuel. But this team, a carbon capture machine from the UK, they are making carbonates. That means they mix CO2 with calcium and they make a solid mineral. The advantage is it's a very low energy process, which means it can be affordable and maybe beat out some of these other approaches based on price and based on operating costs ultimately in the field. And what can you use these carbonate powders for? You should think about chalk. Literally, white powder chalk is calcium carbonate. Okay, so you can make chalk, but even more interesting, you can use that calcium carbonate powder and put it into building materials like concrete, wallboard, etc. That's interesting because the markets are huge and it's a really practical product.
The next one is C2CN2, and they're from the US and they're producing carbon nanotubes. Well, this one's interesting. Carbon nanotubes. What is a carbon nanotube?
Carbon nanotube is, imagine something like a drinking straw. It's long and skinny, has very thin walls, and it's empty in the middle. Now imagine if that drinking straw, that tube, was made not of something solid like steel or plastic, but of a mesh made of carbon atoms. That's what a carbon nanotube is, literally a sheet of carbon atoms rolled up into a skinny tube. Okay, that doesn't sound so interesting. It's maybe interesting if you're into nanotechnology. But what can you do with it? A carbon nanotube has a few uses. Right now, carbon nanotubes are the cutting edge of what could be an electronics revolution. A lot of researchers out there are proposing that carbon nanotubes can replace things like semiconductors and silicon as the core basis of our chips, because you can do interesting electronic things with them that you can't do with semiconductors. On the other hand, the uses of carbon nanotubes today are primarily carbon fiber. Carbon fiber is the thing that fancy bike is made of in the Tour de France, or a tennis racket or skis. It's a very lightweight, durable material, and carbon nanotubes are the basic building block of that existing material today.
It's fascinating the depth and breadth of entrants you get and finalists. How are you able to assess such varying technologies and pick winners?
It's a real challenge, to be honest with you, but that's also where a lot of the dynamism of the competition lies. We put it a challenge, and we're seeing teams come at it from all kinds of different approaches, using different technologies, and as we've discussed, they're making different materials. But you're right, it does pose a challenge for the judges who have to sort through all the performance. Let me run you through how the judges actually select the finalists and are going to select the winner. There's three basic buckets of evaluation criteria. The first one has to do with sustainability. So the judges are measuring, how much water does it take? How much land footprint do you use up? How much energy do you consume? And what's your overall CO2 footprint of your process? Of course, you don't want to produce more CO2 emissions in, let's say, making that carbon nanotube than it takes to actually consume and make into nanotubes. You've got to be reducing CO2 emissions overall. That's the whole point. The second category of criteria has to do with technical variables, like specifically how much carbon dioxide can you pack into your final material? If the material you make only uses a bit of carbon in it, you'll get less points than a team that produces a material that has a lot of carbon in it. We're trying to incentivize uptake of more CO2. The third category has to do with market-oriented variables. A team that can make a product that has a larger market out there in the world, tons sold per year, will get more points than a team that produces a material that has a smaller market. Similarly, we look at the price of the material you actually make. If it's more valuable per ton than another team's material, you get more points. Again, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to incentivize teams to most efficiently and most efficiently in a sustainability sense and in an engineering sense, make a material out of CO2 that also could look like a business opportunity that could therefore be self-sustaining out there in a market economy.
And that's why we have you on the show, because our whole mantra here is it's got to make green sense, it's got to make common sense and economic sense. So we love your philosophy here. One big issue we cover a lot on the show, and it's getting more and more attention, is plastic and plastic waste. Are you thinking about having an X Prize around plastic and being able to clean that up or come up with a alternative that's less or more environmentally friendly?
We are. There's been a lot of conversations, especially in the oceans group here at X Prize, about specifically the oceans plastic problem. I live in Los Angeles. I've been educated through beach cleanups, the amount of plastic that washes into our oceans through big cities like LA and many others. And then, you know, where that ocean plastic ends up. So I think the ocean plastics issue is something that's on the radar of the public, and it's also on our radar internally. We've explored prize designs specifically for ocean plastics and other issues related to environmental plastics. I would say on the topic of alternative plastics, that's, even though that's not the core focus of the Carbon X Prize, it's CO2, that's what we're seeing a lot of our teams focus on. They're focused on making alternative polymers using CO2 as a basis instead of fossil hydrocarbons as the basis for that plastic. So that's got a sustainability advantage on the production side.
Well, Marcus, we can talk for a long time here with the breadth of technologies that you've picked as finalists, but our time's coming to an end, so we'll just have to invite you back on the program as you continue to launch these prizes. We really commend you for your efforts to taking a market-based approach to solving environmental challenges, and we appreciate you being on Green Sense.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
That's Marcus Extivar, XPRIZE Senior Director of Energy and Resources, joining us here on Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo, and we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you. Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Autonomous cars continue to make headlines. While we believe they offer many positives, reduced accidents, reduced fuel usage, not to mention the ability to allow the human to do other things while the car does the driving, it still leaves many questions unanswered. Attorney Art Harrington of the law firm Godfrey & Kahn in Milwaukee is part of an upcoming autonomous car symposium, and he joins us to tell us more. Art, welcome to Green Sense.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, Art, we've heard about all those whiz-bang, futuristic, cool things autonomous cars can offer, but let's have a discussion grounded in market reality about some of the issues and challenges we face in commercializing this technology. And the first one, and right in your bailiwick, is accidents. Let's talk a little bit about the liability and insurance issues that surround accidents caused by autonomous cars.
It's a great topic, Robert. And the challenge here as we start talking about autonomous vehicles and liability going forward is that currently the statistics show that probably 90% of the accidents are caused by operator error. And when you bring in autonomous vehicles and the technology into the discussion looking forward in terms of accidents, the issue then switches from obviously driver error to potentially design or technology defects. And this is going to be a very, very big issue that's going to change the focus of liability and litigation in the future from operator error to more of a focus on technology. And the big challenge in this area, I think, for manufacturers are who's going to take the responsibility for those design or technology errors. In fact, one European manufacturer right now is potentially talking about providing a warranty that will protect the driver, or not the driver, the occupants, from any issues on design error and take it out of the insurance realm. This is what I think you're going to start seeing going forward, is how are the designers here going to deal with alleged design defects going forward? And of course, what this means for the insurance companies is a whole new potential market issue.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. What happens in the future, because we've had this issue on the show a number of times, if the individuals no longer all own the cars, that all the liability stays with the manufacturer, who will now just lease cars and retain all the liability?
Well, it's a great question. You know, the model is still out there for anybody's guess as to how it's going to be developed. I mean, that's, I think, one of the reasons Ford and GM are investing in Uber and Lyft. Are Uber and Lyft going to be the owner-operators, you know, on large fleet manufacturers? Or is it going to be GM or Ford or the big three manufacturers? I mean, the issue is who's going to own the cars? It probably will not be the person using them. It'll be a large fleet operator. And I think that's the big issue now in terms of those ownership issues. And, you know, the driver, the quote occupant, is taken out of the picture potentially for liability, and it rests on that that owner, right?
Yes.
But I think that is why GM and Ford, I think, are looking at that, because they believe it's actually going to be more cars sold than less, which I think is counterintuitive.
So let's move on to another topic, because I'm sure we could talk about the liability insurance issue at a symposium. You could spend a whole week on that. So let's move on to cybersecurity. something that really scares a lot of people, the idea that somebody could hack into an autonomous car, control it, and have accidents. What's out there to protect against that, and what are the issues around this?
Well, you know, let me say it's not just cybersecurity, if I can just make a fine point here, Robert. It's also privacy issues, right? You're raising the issue of cybersecurity, which, of course, is very important. Who could take over control of that vehicle? And you're talking about a missile on wheels, potentially, right? If there is going to be a hacking and somebody can control that. And you are suddenly now talking about so many more modes of interception into that vehicle if you are going to have, you know, connected technology on the roadways as well, controlling traffic, as well as connections in with the car manufacturer, actually monitoring in real time the performance of the vehicle if something is going wrong. So I think the security, you mentioned the cybersecurity issues, are going to be entry points that are going to be increased exponentially for purposes of trying to prevent interceptions. And I think that is a big challenge in the industry right now in terms of future cars with those interconnections versus the present cars, which those cars that are interconnected are in the minority.
I'm speaking with attorney Art Harrington of the law firm Godfrey & Kahn about their upcoming symposium on autonomous cars and what the key issues are. You were making a point there, Art, about cybersecurity?
Well, the other issue, I think, if I could just make a point here, is the privacy issue. When you buy a Tesla right now, in terms of the contract for purchase, your information is not a private matter anymore. Part of the sale contract is that information can be used by the manufacturer. This is going to be very similar issues that I think is so controversial with Facebook right now. The question is, how is the car manufacturer going to be using information for location, et cetera, that is connected with the internet, where you travel, and who is going to regulate that? That is going to be a very important issue, and I think the federal government is trying to get their arms around this, but there has been no national legislation specific to autonomous vehicles on the privacy side either, which I think is a big policy issue.
Well, let's move on to something that's very positive, and this is the idea of having some test autonomous truck lanes from Milwaukee to Chicago. Being a Wisconsin, tell us about this great achievement here or proposed plans.
Well, it's really sort of at the inception at this point, Robert. We have a big, significant manufacturing development occurring with Foxconn locating in the Racine County area. And this has driven a lot of discussions about smart city and the potential use for autonomous trucks. And it's in the very early stages right now, but we are in the process of reconstructing our I-94 corridor, which goes right past the area of the new development. And Wisconsin is, as we speak, filing an application for what's called an infra grant, which they want, if they're successful, to use the reconstruction to put in lanes that eventually could be converted to autonomous lanes in the future by having sort of infrastructure in place, but not dedicated today. The idea would be, if they're successful on this grant, to be able to put in additional technology that would not be dedicated today but could be converted more easily to autonomous lanes in the future. So we think that's pretty exciting. It'll be interesting to see if the U.S. Department of Transportation awards Wisconsin that grant. It could provide us a leg up on future conversions in the future on our interstate system.
Well, that sounds really exciting, and I would love to see that, especially being here in the Chicagoland area. We could actually witness that. There's such overwhelming shortage of truck drivers, we really feel that this is the first place this technology is going to hit. I like to always close on a high note, but this is somewhat of a negative one. In recent weeks, there's been a couple of autonomous car accidents. A woman was killed in Arizona when an Uber autonomous car struck her and as she crossed the street. Uber has now suspended its autonomous car testing. Another was a Tesla driving using autopilot who took his hands off the wheel when you're not supposed to. While two people dying is significant in the grand scheme of things, when you look at all the deaths that occur with humans driving, where do you see this impacting the autonomous car industry? You see autonomous cars leading to fewer lost lives, And do you see these recent injuries and deaths causing any kind of setback?
I think it's definitely, Robert, a short-term, right now, immediate setback. I think this has put a hold on lots of testing, and the excitement around various state legislators trying to move, you know, the AV technology with change in, you know, traffic laws forward. This has put a hold on those discussions until there is, I think, a better understanding of the causation on the technology side as to why this accident happened. I think there are a lot of issues here about the type of LiDAR technology that was used on this Uber car. It was a Volvo, I believe, versus technology used on a lot of other AVs, and whether any changes in those technologies could have had a significant impact on the situation. These are issues that are all being looked at. And so I think it's putting everybody in a pause situation right now, and it's something I think that needs to be addressed to find out what is the actual cause. Did technology have a causal factor, and what was that causal factor, and was it state-of-the-art, or were there other options that were available that could have prevented this accident? I think it's putting everybody on a hold right now, Robert, which I think is a negative until the causal findings are made on that accident.
We really wish you luck on the symposium that you're holding. If anybody wants to find more about it, they can go to the gklaw.com website of Godfrey & Kahn to find out about the symposium. It's being held on May 3rd in Milwaukee, and we appreciate you being on the show.
Robert, it's my pleasure.
You're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this edition of Green Sense, where we're bringing you market-based sustainable solutions. What are we going to learn about next week?
Next week, you know, Robert, I believe last I checked, there are 50 states in the U.S., I think. Let me go count.
What about Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico, I know. Well, I think they should be a state. That's another matter altogether. But which of the 50 states that we know of as states, we know which ones are red and blue, which ones are green. We will have the list of the greenest states and how they got there next week.
Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.